for I come from that alone. I lift her by her hips and lower her back onto me. We share the same relieved moan, both desperate for one another.
"We shouldn't be apart,"
she says, pulling me by my hair until my mouth is level with hers. Can she taste the cowardly goodbye on my breath?
"We have to be,"
I say, as she begins to swivel her hips.
"Fuck."
Tessa lifts herself slowly.
"I won't force you to want me. Not anymore."
I begin to panic, but all my thoughts are lost as she slowly lowers herself back down onto me, only to pull back and then repeat the same torturous movement. She leans forward to kiss me, her tongue lapping around mine as she takes control.
"I want you,"
I breathe into her mouth.
"I always fucking want you. You know that."
A low sound rips through me as her hips quicken their movements.
Holy fuck, she's going to kill me. "You are leaving me."
She glides her tongue across my bottom lip, and I reach down to where our bodies are joined and bring her swollen clit between my fingers.
"I love you,"
I say, unable to find any other words, and she's silenced by my pinching and rubbing her sensitive bud of nerves.
"Oh, God."
Her head falls to my shoulder, and she wraps her arms around my neck.
"I love you."
She practically sobs as she comes, squeezing all around me. I follow directly after, filling her with every drop of me, literally and metaphorically. Minutes of silence pass, and I keep my eyes closed and my arms wrapped around her back. We are both covered in sweat. The heat is still pouring from the vents, but I don't want to let her go long enough to turn it off.
"What are you thinking?"
I finally ask. Her head is resting on my chest, her breathing slow and steady. She doesn't open her eyes when she responds.
"That I wish you could stay with me forever."
Forever. Have I ever wanted anything less with her?
"Me too,"
I say, wishing I could give her the promise of the future that she deserves. After a few more minutes of silence, Tessa's phone buzzes on the floorboard, and on instinct, I reach across and grab it, shifting her body with mine. "It's Kimberly," I say, and hand Tessa the phone. 2 hours later, we are knocking on the door of Kimberly's hotel room. I'm almost convinced that we are at the wrong room when I take in Kimberly's appearance. Her eyes are swollen, and she doesn't have an ounce of makeup on. I like her better that way, but she just looks so wrecked right now, like she's been crying all her tears plus somebody else's.
"Come in. It's been a long morning,"
she says, her normal sass completely absent. Tessa immediately hugs her, wrapping her arms around her friend's waist, and Kimberly begins to sob. I feel incredibly uncomfortable just standing in the doorway, given that Kim irritates the shit out of me, and that she isn't the type that wants an audience while she's vulnerable. I leave them in the sitting room of the grand suite and wander into the kitchen area. I pour a cup of coffee and stare at the wall until the sobs turn into muffled voices in the other room. I'll keep my distance for now.
"Is my dad coming back?"
A smooth voice says from somewhere, causing me to jerk in surprise. Looking down, I see the green-eyed Smith has taken a seat in a plastic chair next to me. I didn't even hear him approaching. I shrug and take a seat next to him, staring intensely at the wall. "Yeah, I think so." I should tell him just what a fucking great man his father, our father, really is. Holy shit. This strange little specimen of a kid is my fucking brother. I absolutely can't wrap my head around it. I look over at Smith, which he takes as a cue to continue his line of questioning.
"Kimberly said that he's in trouble, but he can pay his way out of it. What does that mean?"
I can't stop the scoff that comes from my mouth at his intrusive eavesdropping and thorough questioning. "I'm sure that's the case," I mumble. She just means that he will be out of trouble soon. Why don't you go sit with Kimberly and Tessa? My chest burns at the sound of her name as it comes from my mouth. He looks over in the direction of their voices, then assesses me sagely.
They're mad at you, especially Kimberly, but she's more mad at my dad, so you should be okay.
You'll learn that women are always mad. He nods.
Unless they die, like my mom did.
My mouth falls open and I look at his face. You shouldn't say shit like that. People will find it odd. He shrugs his shoulders as if to say that people already find him odd, which is true, I suppose.
My dad is nice. He's not bad.
Okay. I stare down at the table to avoid looking into those green eyes.
He takes me a lot of places and says nice things to me.
Spith places a piece of a toy train on the table. What is it with this boy and trains? And, I say, swallowing the feelings that come with his words. Why is he rambling about this now?
He will take you places, too, and tell you nice things.
I look over at him. And why would I want that? I ask. But his green eyes tell me that he knows much more than I assumed. Smith tilts his head and swallows a little swallow, watching me. It's both the most scientifically detached and the most vulnerably childlike I have ever seen the little oddball.
You don't want me to be your brother, do you?
Damn it. I desperately search for Tessa, hoping that she will come save me. She would know exactly what to say. I look at him, trying to appear calm, but certain I'm failing. I never said that.
You don't like my dad.
Right then, Tessa and Kimberly enter, saving me from having to answer him. Thank God.
Are you okay, honey?
Kimberly asks him, ruffling his hair slightly. Smith doesn't speak. He merely nods once, adjusts his hair, and takes his train car with him into the other room.
Chapter 9. Tessa. Just use the shower here. You look like hell, girl, Kimberly says in a kind voice despite the unflattering words. Hardin is still sitting at the table, a cup of coffee between his large hands. He has barely looked at me since I walked into the kitchen to find him talking to Smith. The idea of the two of them spending time together as brothers warms my heart. All of my clothes are in the rental car at that bar, I tell her. I want nothing more than a shower, but I don't have any clothes to wear. You can wear something of mine, she suggests, even though we both know I could never fit into her clothes. Or Christian's. He has some shorts and a shirt you...
No. Hell no.
Hardin interrupts, throwing Kimberly a hard glare as he stands.
I'll go get your shit. You aren't wearing his clothes.
Kimberly opens her mouth to argue, but closes it before the words can come. I look at her with thankful eyes, grateful that a war won't be started in the kitchen of her hotel suite. How far is Gabriel's from here? I ask, hoping one of them knows the answer.
10 minutes.
Hardin holds his hand out for the keys to the car. Can you drive? I made the drive back from All Hallows because the alcohol was still in his system, and his eyes are still glassy.
Yes,
he says tersely. Wonderful. Kimberly's suggestion that I borrow Christian's clothing has turned Hardin from sullen to pissed off in under a minute. Do you want me to come? I could drive the rental back since you're driving Christian's car, I begin, but I'm quickly cut off.
No, I'll be fine.
I don't like his impatient tone, but I bite my tongue, literally, to keep from telling him off. I don't know what has gotten into me lately, but I find it harder and harder to keep my mouth shut. This can only be a good thing for me, maybe not for Hardin, but certainly for me. He leaves the suite without another word or so much as a glance back to me. I stare at the wall for long, silent minutes before Kimberly's voice breaks my trance. How is he handling it? She leads me over to the table. Not well. We both grab a seat. I
can see that. Burning a house down probably isn't the healthiest way to deal with anger,
she says, without a single hint of judgment in her words. I stare at the dark wood on the table, not willing to meet the eyes of my friend. It's not his anger that I'm afraid of. I can feel him withdrawing with every breath he takes. I know it's childish and selfish of me to even mention this to you, because you are going through all of this and Christian is in trouble. It's probably best that I keep my selfish thoughts to myself. Kimberly places her hand on mine. Tessa, there is no rule that says only one person can feel pain at a time. You're going through this just as much as I am. I know, but I don't want to bother you with my prob- You aren't bothering me. Spill. I look up at her with the intent to stay quiet, to keep my complaints to myself, but she shakes her head as if she can read my mind. He wants to stay here in London, and I know if I let him, we will be finished. She smiles. You two seem to have a different definition of finished than the rest of us. I want to throw my arms around her neck for giving me such a warm smile in the middle of hell. I know it's hard to believe me when I say that given our history, but this whole thing with Christian and Trish will either be the nail in our coffin or our saving grace. I don't see any other outcome, and now I guess I'm afraid of which it'll be. Tessa, you have too much weighing on you. Vent to me. Vent and vent some more. Nothing you say will make me think any less of you or anything. Like the selfish bitch I am, I need someone else's problems to distract me from my own issues right now. I don't wait for Kimberly to change her mind. Instead, the floodgates open and the words pour from my mouth like uncontrollable rushing waters. Hardin wants to stay in London. He wants to stay here and send me back to Seattle like some burden that he can't wait to unload. He's withdrawing from me, like he always does every single time he's hurt. And now he's gone off the deep end and burned that house down and has absolutely no remorse. I know he's angry, and I would never say this to him, but he's only making things worse for himself. If he would just deal with his anger and admit that he can feel pain, admit that someone other than himself or me is important in this world, he could get through this. He infuriates me because he tells me that he can't live without me and would rather die than lose me. But as soon as the going gets tough, what does he do? He pushes me away. I'm not going to give up on him. I'm in far too deep for that now. But sometimes I just feel so tired of battling that I start to think about what my life would have been without him. I pull my eyes up to Kimberly's, but when I start to picture it, I nearly collapse from the pain. I grab the half-empty cup of coffee from the table and down it. My voice is better than it was a few hours ago, but my ranting has taken its toll on my sore throat. It doesn't make sense to me still, after all these months, all this turmoil, that I would rather do all of this. I wave my hand around the room in a dramatic gesture, than be without him. The worst of times with him have been nothing compared to the best. I don't know if I'm delusional or insane. Maybe both. But I love him more than myself. More than I ever thought possible, and I just want him to be happy. Not for me, but for him. I want him to look in the mirror and smile, not scowl. I need him to not think of himself as a monster. I need him to see the real him, because if he doesn't pull himself out of the villain role, it will destroy him, and I'll just be left with ashes. Please don't tell him or even Christian any of this. I just needed to get it all out because I feel like I'm drowning and it's hard to keep myself above water, especially when I'm fighting against the current to save him rather than myself. My voice cracks at that last bit, and I become a coughing mess. Smiling, Kimberly opens her mouth to speak, but I hold up a finger. I clear my throat. There's more. On top of all of this, I went to the doctor to get birth control. I say, nearly whispering the last words. Kimberly tries her best not to laugh, but fails utterly. No need to whisper. Spit it out, girl. Fine. I flush. I got on birth control, and my doctor did a quick scan of my cervix. He said that it's short, shorter than average, and he wants me to come in for more testing, but he mentioned infertility. I look over to see sympathy in her blue eyes. My sister has the same thing. They like to call it cervical incompetence, I think. What a horrible term. Incompetence makes it sound like her vagina got an F in math or was a shitty lawyer or something. Kimberly's attempt at humor, and that she knows someone with the same problem I may have, makes me feel better, a little. "And does she have children?" I ask, but instantly regret it as her face falls.
"I don't know if you want to hear about her right now. I could tell you another time."
"Tell me. I shouldn't want to hear it, but I can't help it. Please?" I beg. Kimberly takes a deep breath.
"She struggled to get pregnant for years. It was terrible for her. They tried fertility treatments. Anything you can find on Google, she and her husband tried."
"And?" I press her to hurry along, reminding myself of Hardin right now, rudely interrupting her. I hope he's on his way back. In this state, Hardin can't be left to his own devices.
"Well, she was finally able to get pregnant, and it was the happiest day of her life."
Kimberly looks away from me, and I know she's either lying or leaving something out for my sake. "What happened? How old is the baby now?" Kimberly clasps her hands together and looks me square in the eyes.
"She was 4 months along when she miscarried. But that is only what happened to her. Don't get yourself distraught over her story. You may not even have the same thing, and if you do, things may be different for you."
With a hollow ringing in my ears, I say, "I have this feeling, just this gut feeling that I won't be able to get pregnant. The moment the doctor mentioned infertility, it was like it just clicked." Kimberly grabs my hand on the table.
"You don't know that for sure. And not to be a downer, but Hardin doesn't want kids anyway, right?"
Even with the small knife twisting into my chest from her words, I feel better now that I have told someone about my worries. "No, he doesn't. He doesn't want children or marriage with me."
"Were you hoping he would change his mind?"
She gives me a little squeeze. "Yes, sadly, I was. I was almost sure he would. Not right now, of course, but years from now. I thought maybe if he was older and we both were finished with college, he would eventually change his mind. But now that seems even more delusional than before. I feel my cheeks flush in embarrassment. I can't believe I'm actually saying these things aloud. I know I sound ridiculous worrying over children at my age, but being a mother was always something I wanted since I can remember. I don't know if it's because my mother and father weren't the best parents, but I've always felt this urge, this need, to be a mother. Not just a mother, but a really good one. A mother that would love her children unconditionally. I would never judge them or belittle them. I would never pressure them or humiliate them. I wouldn't try to mold them into a better version of myself. At first, talking about this, I felt insane. But Kimberly is nodding along to everything I'm saying, making me feel like maybe I'm not the only one who feels this way. I think I would be a good mother, if I was ever given the chance, and the idea of a little brown-haired, gray-eyed little girl running into Hardin's arms brings my heart to my throat. I imagine it sometimes. I know it's stupid, but sometimes I picture them sitting there, both of them with unruly wavy hair. I laugh at the ludicrous vision, one that I have imagined far more times than could possibly be considered normal. He would read to her and carry her on his shoulders, and she would have him wrapped around her finger. I force a smile, trying to erase the sweet image from my head. But he doesn't want that. And now that he has learned about Christian being his father, I know he never, ever will. Tucking my hair behind my ears, I'm surprised and more than a little proud of myself that I made it through all that without a single tear.
Chapter 10. Hardin.
"I wish you could stay with me forever."
Tessa had said that against my chest. It's what I wanted to hear. It's what I need to hear. Forever. But why would she possibly want forever with me? What would that even be like? Tessa and I in our 40s with no children, no marriage. Just the two of us. That would be perfect for me. That would be my absolute ideal future. But I know that would never be enough for her. We've had the same argument too many times to count, and I know that she would be the first to cave, because I never would. Being an asshole means being the most stubborn, and she would give up having children and a marriage for me. Besides, what kind of father would I be? A shitty one, that's for damn sure. I can't get through the question in my mind without laughing. It's ridiculous to even consider. As fucked up as this trip has been, it's been a giant fucking wake-up call for me when it comes to my relationship with Tessa. I've always tried to warn her, tried to keep her from going down with me, but I never tried hard enough. If I'm being honest, I know I could have pushed harder to keep her safe from me, but, selfishly, I couldn't. Now seeing the way that her life will be with me, I have no other choice. This trip has cleared the romantic fog from my head, and miraculously, I have been granted the opportunity to have an easy way out. I can send her back to America, and she can get on with her life. Tessa's future with me is nothing but a lonely black hole for her. I would get everything I wanted from her, her constant love and affection for years and years, but she would be left unfulfilled, and as every year passes, she will resent me more and more for depriving her of what she truly wanted. I might as well cut out the middleman and save her the wasted time. When I arrive at Gabriel's, I quickly throw Tessa's bag into the back seat and head back to Kimberly's hotel. I need a plan, a solid fucking plan that I will actually stick to. She is too stubborn and too in love with me to just give up on me. That's her problem. She's one of those people who will give and give without taking. And the fucked up truth is that people like her are the easiest prey for someone like me, who takes and takes until there is nothing left. That's what I have done since the beginning, and that's what I will always do. She will try to convince me otherwise. I know she will. She will say that marriage isn't important anymore, but she would just be lying to herself to keep me around. That says a lot about me, that I have manipulated her into loving me so unconditionally. The masochist in me starts to doubt her love as I drive. Does she love me as much as she says, or is she addicted to me? There is a heady difference, and the more shit she puts up with from me, the more it seems like an addiction. The thrill of waiting for me to fuck up again so she can be there to fix me. That's what this is. She must see me as a project, someone she can fix. The conversation has come up before, more than once, but she refused to admit it. I fish through my memories for a specific encounter, and finally find it floating somewhere in my muddled, hungover brain. It was right after my mum left to go back to London after Christmas, and Tessa had looked up at me with worried eyes.
Harden?
Yeah? I had asked, speaking through the pen between my teeth.
Will you help me take this tree down when you're finished working?
I wasn't actually working. I was writing, but she didn't know that. We had had a long and interesting day. I had caught her coming back from lunch with fucking Trevor, and then I'd bent her over her desk and fucked her senseless. Yes, just give me a minute. I tucked the pages away, afraid that she would see them while cleaning up, and stood to help her take down the tiny tree she'd decorated with my mum.
What are you working on anyway? Is it anything good?
She reached for the tattered binder she constantly complained about my leaving around the house. The coffee cup rings and pen marks covering the weathered leather drove her insane.
Nothing!
I jerked it from her hands before she could open it. She pulled back, obviously surprised and a little hurt by my actions.
Sorry,
she said quietly. A deep frown set across her beautiful face, and I tossed the binder on the couch and reached for her hands.
I was just asking. I didn't mean to pry or upset you.
Fuck, I was such a prick. I still am. It's fine, just don't mess with my work shit. I don't. I couldn't come up with an excuse as to why, because I hadn't stopped her in the past. Whenever I came across a draft that I knew she would like, I would share it with her. She loved when I did that, and there I was scolding her for doing it now.
Okay.
She turned away from me and started to pull the ornaments off the hideous tree. I stared at her back for a few minutes, wondering why I was so angry. If she read what I was writing, how would she feel? Would she like it? or would she be appalled and throw a fit? I didn't know, and I still don't, which is why she still has no clue about it to this day. Okay, that's all you have to say? I picked at her, wanting a fight. Fighting was better than ignoring. Shouts were better than silence.
I won't mess with your things anymore, she said without turning to look at me. I didn't know you would be so upset.
I struggled to find something to fight about. Then I just went for the bone.
Why are you even with me?
I asked roughly.
After everything that happened, is it the drama that you like? What?
She spun around, a small snowflake ornament in her hands.
Why are you starting a fight with me? I said I wouldn't touch your things anymore.
I'm not starting a fight, I lied. I just want to know, because it seems like you are addicted to the drama and ups and downs more than anything. I knew it wasn't fair to say, but I said it anyway. I was in a mood and wanted her to join me. She stepped toward me, dropping the ornament into the box next to the tree.
You know that isn't true. I love you, even when you are looking for a fight with me. I hate the drama. You know that. I love you for you. End of story.
She leaned up on her toes to kiss my cheek, and I wrapped my arms around her.
Why do you love me then?
I do nothing for you, I argued weakly. The scene I'd caused at Vance's earlier that day was fresh in my mind. She took a patient breath and rested her head against my chest.
This,
she tapped her index finger over my heart.
That's why. Now please stop trying to fight me. I have a paper to work on, and this tree won't put itself away.
She was so gentle with me, so understanding, even when I didn't deserve it. I love you, I said into her hair and moved my hands to her hips. She molded into me, letting me lift her into my arms, and she wrapped her legs around my waist as I carried her across the living room to the couch.
I love you always. Don't doubt me. I will always love you,
she assured me, her mouth against mine. I undressed her slowly, savoring every inch of her sexy curves. I loved the way her eyes went wide as I rolled the condom on. That same afternoon she had been nervous about fucking while on her period, but her chest was moving up and down with rapid jerks as I began to stroke myself in front of her. Impatient breaths and a small whine was all it took for me to stop teasing her. I moved between her thighs and pushed into her slowly. She was so wet and tight. I lost myself in her, and I still can't remember how that damn tree got stored away. I've been doing this too much lately, dwelling on happy memories from my time with her. My hands are shaking, gripping the steering wheel as I pull myself from my mind. Her moans and whimpers fade away as I force myself back to the present. I'm waiting in a slow line of traffic, only a few miles away from Tessa. I need to solidify my plan and make sure her ass is on that plane tonight. It's a late flight, not departing until 9, so she will have plenty of time to make it to Heathrow. Kimberly will take her there. I know she will. My head still hurts. The liquor is making a slow departure from my body, and I still feel a little tipsy. Not so much so that I can't drive, but my mind isn't all there.
Harden!
A familiar voice says. The voice is muffled by my window, so I quickly roll it down. Every time I turn around, someone from my past is there, calling my name.
Holy shit!
I yell to the car next to me. My old friend Mark is in the next lane. If this isn't a sign from above, I don't know what is.
Pull over!
He shouts back, a wide grin spreading across his face. I pull Vance's rental into the lot of an ice cream shop, and he parks next to me. He's out of his piece-of-shit car before I am, and rushes over to yank my door open.
You're back and you didn't even tell me!
He yells, patting me on the shoulder.
And damn! Tell me this Beamer is a rental, or did you get rich on me?
I roll my eyes. Long story, but it's a rental.
Are you back for good or what?
His brown hair is cropped short now, but his eyes are just as glazed over as they always were.
Yeah, I'm back for good,
I answer, settling it. I'm staying here, and she's going back. Simple as that. He studies my face.
Where are your fucking rings? You took them out?
Yeah, I got sick of them, I shrug, but examine his face. When he turns his head a little, the light catches two little studs beneath his lips. Damn, the kid got snake bites.
Damn, Scott, you look so different. It's fucking crazy. It's been what, 2 years?
He throws his hands up.
3. Hell, I've been high for the last 10 years, so I couldn't tell you.
He laughs and digs into his pocket to pull out a pack of smokes. I decline when he offers me one, which earns me a raised brow.
What? You like straight edge now?
He accuses.
No, I just don't want a fucking cigarette,
I snap. He laughs the way he always did when I would get this way. He was always the leader of our little group of delinquents. Older than me by a year, but enough that I always looked up to him, in a way, and wanted to be like him. That's why when an even older guy named James came along, and he and Mark started the games, I jumped right in. It didn't bother me the way they treated girls, even when they taped them without their knowledge.
You're a bitch now, aren't you?
He smiles, his lit cigarette between his teeth.
Fuck off. You're high right now, aren't you?
I knew he would always remain this way. Always high and stuck in his glory days of fucking loads of chicks and staying high.
Nah, I'm coming off of a long night, though.
He grins, obviously proud of himself as he remembers whatever, or whoever, he did last night.
Where are you headed now? You staying at your mum's?
My chest tightens at the mention of my mum and the house that I burned to the ground. I can feel the hot smoke on my cheeks and see the bright flames swallowing the house when I looked back before climbing into the car with Tessa.
No, I'm staying between places. Ah, got it.
He doesn't get it, though.
If you need a place to crash, you can stay at my place. James is my roommate now. He'd get a kick out of seeing your grown ass too, all Americanized and shit.
I can hear Tessa's voice in my head now, begging me not to go down this familiar, easy road. But I ignore her protests and nod at Mark. I need a favor, actually.
I can find you anything you need. James sells now,
Mark responds with some pride. I roll my eyes.
That isn't what I mean.
You need to follow me to my hotel so I can drop something off, then take me to Gabriel's to get my car. I will have to extend the rental time, if they'll allow it. I choose to ignore that an entire apartment and a car are back in Washington. I'll figure that shit out later.
Then you'll come to my flat.
He stops.
Wait, who are you dropping shit off to?
Even high, he didn't miss that detail. There is no fucking way in hell I'm telling Mark about Tessa. No fucking way.
Just some chick.
I feel the burn in my throat as I lie about who Tessa is to me. But I need to protect her from this. He walks back over to his car, pausing before he gets in.
She hot? I can wait outside if you need to fuck her again. Or maybe she'll let me.
My vision goes red and I take a few breaths to calm down.
No, fuck no, not happening. You'll stay in the car. I'm not even going inside.
When he doesn't look convinced, I add,
I mean it. If you get out of the fucking car and go anywhere near, dude, chill the fuck out. I'll stay in the car,
he shouts and holds up his hands like I'm a cop. He's still laughing and shaking his head as he follows me out of the parking lot and back onto the street.
Chapter 11. Tessa. I check my phone where it's plugged into the wall. He's been gone for over an hour. I try to call him again. He's probably just taking his time, Kimberly says, but I can see the doubt in her eyes as she tries to comfort me. He's not answering. If he went back to that bar, I stand up and begin pacing. He'll probably pull up any minute. She opens the door and peeks out, looking left and right, then down. She says my name quietly, but her voice sounds off. Something's not right. What? What is it? Is Harden in the hallway? I zip over to where Kimberly is, just as she bends down, and grabs my suitcase. Dread takes over, bringing me to my knees. I barely feel Kimberly's arms around me as I open the front pocket of the suitcase. An airline ticket. A single airline ticket is there. Next to it, Harden's keychain with the keys to his car and apartment still attached. I knew this was coming. I knew he would back away from me the moment he could. Harden can't handle any type of emotional trauma. He just isn't equipped. I could have, should have been preparing for this. So why does this ticket feel so heavy in my hand and my chest feel like it's on fire? I hate him for doing this to me, so quickly and out of anger, and I hate myself for not preparing for this. I should be tough right now. I should pick up the tiny scrap of dignity I haven't lost and stand tall. I should take this ticket, grab my damn suitcase, and get the hell out of London. That's what any self-respecting woman would do. It's simple, isn't it? I keep this thought in my head as my knees buckle below me, my hands shake, covering the embarrassment on my face as I break into pieces over this man. Again. He's an ass. Kimberly insults Harden as if I didn't already know he's an asshole. You know he will come back. He always does. She says against my hair. I look at her and I can see the anger and the protective friend threat in her eyes. I gently pull myself out of her arms and shake my head. I'm okay. I'm fine. I'm okay, I chant, more so to myself than to Kim. You aren't, she corrects me, tucking a wild strand of my hair behind my ear. I get a glimpse of Harden's hands doing that exact gesture, and I pull away. I need a shower, I say to my friend, just before I lose it. No, not broken. I'm not broken. I'm defeated. What I feel right now is purely defeat. I've spent months and months fighting against the inevitable, pushing against a current that was much too big to brave alone, and now I've been swallowed into it with no lifeboats in sight. Tessa? Tessa, are you okay? Kimberly yells from the other side of the bathroom door. I'm fine, I manage, the words sounding as weak as I feel. If I don't feel an ounce of strength, I can attempt to hide some of the weakness. The water is cold now. It's been cold for minutes, maybe even an hour. I haven't the slightest idea of how much time I've been in here, crouched down on the floor of the shower, my knees folded against my chest, the cold water spraying down on me. It was borderline painful a while ago, but my body went numb a few Kimberly checkups ago. You have to get out of that shower. Don't think I won't break the door down. I don't doubt for a second that she would do just that. I've ignored that threat a few times already, but this time I reach up and turn the shower off. Still, I make no move to leave my spot on the floor. Seemingly satisfied that the water's gone off, I don't hear from Kimberly for another little while, but the next time she pounds, I call back to her. I'm getting out. By the time I stand up, my legs are wobbly and my hair is almost dry. I dig into my bag and go through the mechanics of pulling on my jeans. One leg, then the next. Lift arms above head, pull shirt down over stomach. I feel like a robot, and when I wipe my hand across the mirror, I see that I look like one too. How many times will he do this? I silently ask my reflection. No. How many times will I let him do this? That's the real question. No more, I say out loud to the stranger looking back at me. I will find him, this last time, and only for the sake of his family. I will drag his ass out of London and do what I should have done a long time ago.
Chapter 12. Harden.
Damn, Scott! Look at you, you're a fucking mammoth!
James stands up from the couch and moves toward me. It's true. Compared to both him and Mark, I'm fucking huge.
What are you? 6 foot fucking ten?
James's eyes are glassy and bloodshot. It's barely one in the afternoon. 6'3", I correct, and receive the same friendly greeting Mark gave, a firm hand on my shoulder.
This is fucking awesome! We need to get the word out that you're back! Everyone's still here, man!
James rubs his hands together like he's plotting something big, and I don't even want to know what that might be. Has Tessa found the bag outside of the door yet? What did she think about it? Did she cry? Or is she beyond that now? I sure as hell don't want the answer to that question. I don't want to picture her face when she opened the door. I don't even want to think about the way she felt when she saw only one ticket stuffed into the front pocket of that suitcase. All my clothes have been removed from it and tossed into the back seat of my rental. I know her well enough to know that she's going to expect a goodbye from me. She's going to try to find me before she gives up. But after her one last effort, she will give up. She won't have a choice, because she will never be able to find me before the flight. And by tomorrow, she'll be far, far gone from me.
Dude!
Mark's voice is loud and his hand is waving in front of my face.
Are you fucking zoning out?
My bad, I say with a shrug. But then it occurs to me. If Tessa gets lost in London looking for me, what will I do? Anything? Mark puts his arm around me, pulling me into the conversation he and James have broken into as they decide who to invite over. They name loads of familiar names, and a few that I haven't heard, and start making phone calls for a midday party, barking out times and liquor orders. I pull away and go into the kitchen to look for a glass for some water, looking around the apartment for the first time since I walked through the door. It's a fucking mess. It looks the way the frat house did every Saturday and Sunday morning. Our apartment never looked this way. Not when Tessa was around, at least. The counters were never covered in old pizza boxes, and the tables were free of beer bottles and bongs. I'm backsliding, and I fucking know it. Speaking of bongs, I don't even have to look over at Mark and James to know what they're doing now. I hear the bubbling noise of the water in the bong, then the distinct smell of pot starts filling the place. Masochist that I am, I pull my phone out of my pocket and turn the power back on. The picture I have set as my wallpaper is my new favourite of Tess, for now, at least. My favourite changes every damn week, but this one is fucking perfection. Her blonde hair is down, hanging over her shoulders, and the light is shining on her, making her glow. A true smile fills her entire face, and her eyes are screwed shut, her nose crinkled in the most adorable fucking way. She was laughing at me, scolding me, really, for smacking her ass in front of Kimberly, and I'd snapped the picture just as she burst into laughter after I whispered to her the other, much dirtier things I could do in front of her obnoxious friend. I wander back into the living room, and James snatches my phone from my hand.
Give me some of whatever you're on.
I'm quick to take it back before he can get a glance at the picture.
Touchy, touchy!
James mocks me as I change the background. No need to fuel these fuckers.
I invited Janine,
Mark says, sharing a laugh with James.
I don't know why you two are laughing.
I point to Mark.
She's your sister.
Then I point at James.
And you fucked her too.
Not like this is surprising. Mark's sister is known for fucking every single one of her little brother's friends.
Fuck you, man!
James takes another hit from the bong and passes it to me. Tessa would fucking kill me. She would be so disappointed. She doesn't approve of me drinking, let alone smoking pot.
Hit it or pass it,
Mark urges.
If Janine is coming over, you'll need it. She's still hot as fuck,
James tells me, earning a glare from Mark and a laugh from me. Hours pass this way, smoking, dwelling, drinking, dwelling, smoking. And before I know it, the place is full of people. including the girl in question.
Chapter 13. Tessa. I may not have much, but I still have a little pride, and I would rather face Harden by myself and have this conversation one-on-one. I know exactly what he's going to do. He's going to tell me that I am too good for him and that he is no good for me. He's going to say something hurtful, and I will try to convince him otherwise. I know Kimberly must think I'm a fool for chasing after him after his cold dismissal, but I love him, and this is what you do when you love someone. You fight for him. You chase after him when you know he needs you. You help him fight the battle against himself, and you never give up on him, even when he gives up on himself. I'm fine. If I find him and you're with me, he will feel cornered and it will make things worse, I tell Kimberly for the second time. Be careful, please. I don't want to have to kill that kid, but at this point, nothing is off the table. She half smiles at me. Wait, one more thing. Kimberly raises a finger and rushes over to the coffee table in the center of the room. She digs through her purse and then waves me over. Kimberly, being Kimberly, brushes a shiny, colorless gloss across my lips and hands me a tube of mascara. She grins. You want to look your best, right? Despite the ache in my chest, I smile at her effort to help me look decent. Of course that is part of the equation to her. 10 minutes later, my cheeks are no longer red from crying. The puffiness around my eyes is less noticeable, thanks to concealer and a little shadow. My hair is brushed and somewhat controlled into large waves. Kimberly gave up after a few minutes, sighing, then saying that beach waves are in right now anyway. I don't remember her changing me out of my t-shirt and into a tank top and cardigan, but she has transformed me from a zombie in a remarkably short time. Promise me that you will call if you need me, Kimberly insists. Don't think I won't come looking for you. I nod in agreement, knowing that she won't hesitate. She hugs me twice more before giving me the keys to Christian's rental, which Harden left in the parking lot. When I get into the car, I plug my phone into the charger and roll the window all the way down. The car smells like Harden, and the empty coffee cups from this morning are still in their holders, reminding me of the way he made love to me only hours ago. That was his goodbye to me. I realize now that part of me knew it then, but just wasn't ready to accept it. I didn't want to admit the defeat that was skimming around the surface, waiting to encase me. It doesn't seem possible that it's almost 5 o'clock. I have less than 2 hours to find Harden and convince him to come back home with me. The flight boards at 8:30, but we have to arrive a bit before 7 to go through security just to be safe. Will I be flying home alone? I look at myself in the rearview mirror, facing that same girl who had to pull herself up off that bathroom floor. I acknowledge the sick feeling that tells me I'll be on that airplane alone. I only know one place to look for him, and if he isn't there, I have no idea what I will do. I start the car up, but pause with my hand on the gear shift. I can't drive aimlessly around London with no money and nowhere to go. Desperate and worried, I try to call him again, and I nearly burst into happy tears when he picks up the phone.
Hello, who is this?
An unrecognizable male voice says. I pull the phone away to be sure I called the right number, but Harden's name is clear across the screen.
Hello,
the man says louder, drawing out the word again. Hi. Is Harden there? My stomach twists. It knows that this guy is bad news, although I don't have a clue who he is. Laughter and multiple voices echo in the background. More than one of them are female voices.
Scott is disposed at the moment,
the man tells me. Disposed?
It's indisposed, you idiot, a woman yells in the background, laughing.
Oh, God, where is he? I can tell I've been put on speakerphone the way the noise changes.
He's busy,
another guy says.
Who's this? You coming to the party? Is that why you called? I like your American accent, Birdie, and if you're a friend of Scott's...
A party? At only 5? I try to focus on that useless fact rather than the multiple female voices bursting through my phone and the fact that Harden is busy. Yeah. My mouth answers before my brain agrees. I need the address again. My voice is shaky and unsure, but they don't seem to notice. The man who answered the phone gives me an address, and I quickly type it into the navigation on my phone. It crashes twice, and I have to ask him to repeat himself, but he obliges and tells me to hurry, bragging proudly that there is more liquor there than I've ever seen in my life. 20 minutes later, I'm in the small lot adjoining a run-down brick building. The windows are large, and the three of them are covered in what looks like white tape or possibly garbage bags. The lot is full of cars. The BMW that I drove here sticks out like a sore thumb. The only car even close in resemblance is Hardin's rental. It's near the front, blocked in, meaning he's been here longer than most of the others. When I reach the door of the building, I take a deep breath to gather my strength. The stranger on the phone said it was the second door on the third floor. The shady building doesn't seem large enough to have three floors, but as I climb the stairs, I'm proven wrong. Loud voices and the thick smell of marijuana hit me before I even reach the top of the staircase on the second floor. Looking up, I have to wonder why Hardin would be here. Why would he come to this place to deal with his issues? As I reach the third floor, my heart is racing and my stomach is tied in knots as my mind flips through all of the possible things that could be happening behind the scarred and graffitied door number two. I shake my head, clearing all the doubts. Why am I so paranoid and nervous? This is Hardin I'm talking about. My Hardin. Even mad and withdrawn, beyond cruel words, he would never do anything to purposely hurt me. He's going through a hard time with all of his family issues, and he just needs me to stomp in there and take him home with me. I'm psyching myself out and getting worked up for nothing. The door opens just before I reach up to knock, and a young guy wearing all black walks past me without stopping or closing the door behind him. Waves of smoke roll out into the hallway, and I have to fight the urge to cover my nose and mouth. I step across the threshold, coughing, and stop in my tracks at the sight in front of me. Shocked by the sight of a half-naked girl sitting on the floor, I look around the room and notice that nearly everyone is half-naked.
"Lose the top,"
a young guy with a beard says to a bleach-blonde girl. She rolls her eyes but quickly disposes of her shirt, leaving her in only a bra and panties. Staring at the scene a little longer, I realize that they are playing some sort of card game that involves taking their clothes off. This realization is much better than the initial conclusion my mind went to, but only a little. I'm slightly relieved that Hardin isn't in the group of increasingly naked card players, and I scan the crowded living room but don't see him.
"You coming in or what?"
someone asks. I look around, searching for the source of the voice.
"Close the door behind you and come in,"
he says, stepping forward from behind someone at my left.
"Have I met you before, Bambi?"
He chuckles, and I shift uncomfortably as his bloodshot eyes rake over my body, staying too long on my chest to be considered anything but vulgar. I don't like his chosen nickname for me, but I can't seem to find a way to tell him my real name. Given the sound of his voice, I'm sure he's the person that answered Hardin's phone. I shake my head. All words have dissolved on my tongue.
"Mark."
He introduces himself, reaching for my hand, but I flinch away. Mark. I instantly recognize the name from Hardin's letter and other stories about him. He's friendly enough, but I know how he really is. I know what he did to all those girls.
"This is my flat. Who invited you?"
At first, I think he's mad because of the question, but his face just reads bravado instead. His accent is thick, and he is attractive. Somewhat frightening, but attractive. His brown hair is sticking up at the front, and his facial hair is messy yet groomed. A douchebag hipster look, as Hardin calls it, but I find it decent. His arms are bare of any tattoos, but two piercings stick out below his bottom lip. I struggle to get a grip on my nerves. He laughs again and grabs hold of my hand.
"Well, Bambi, let's get you a drink to relax you."
He smiles.
"You're freaking me out."
As he leads me to the kitchen, I'm beginning to wonder if Hardin is even here. Maybe he dropped the car here and his phone before going someplace else. Maybe he's in the car. Why didn't I check it? I should probably go down and do that. He was so tired, he just might be napping. Then my breath is knocked clear from my chest. If anyone were to ask me how I feel right now, I'm not sure what I would say. I don't think I'd have an answer. There's pain and heartache and panic and rejection, but at the same time, I feel numb. I feel nothing and everything at once, and it's the worst sensation I have ever felt. Leaning against the counter with a joint between his lips and a bottle of liquor in one hand is Hardin. But that's not what makes my heart stop. What stole my breath is the woman sitting on the counter behind him, her bare legs wrapped around his waist, her body around him like it was the most natural thing in the world.
"Scott, give me the damn vodka. I need to make my new friend Bambi here a drink,"
Mark yells. Hardin's bloodshot eyes turn to Mark, and Hardin smiles nastily, a dark look that I have never before seen from him. As he turns from Mark to me to find out who Bambi is, I'm close enough to see his dilated pupils blow out, instantly wiping away that foreign expression.
"What? What are you?"
He fumbles the words. His eyes follow down my arm and somehow grow even larger as he takes in the sight of Mark's hand over mine. Pure rage fills Hardin's face, and I pull my hand away.
"You two know each other?"
my party host asks. I don't respond. Rather, my eyes narrow in on the woman whose legs are still wrapped around Hardin's waist. He still hasn't made any move to remove her from him. She's wearing only panties and a t-shirt. A plain black t-shirt. Hardin is wearing his black sweatshirt, but I don't see the familiar peak of a faded t-shirt collar underneath. This random girl is oblivious of the tension, focused only on the joint she just pulled from Hardin's mouth. She even smiles at me, a clueless, obviously intoxicated smile. I have been rendered silent, stunned to even imagine that I know this person now before me. I don't think I could speak even if I wanted to. I know Hardin is in a dark place right now, but seeing him like this, high and drunk and with another woman, is too much for me. It's too fucking much, and all I can think of doing is getting as far away as possible.
"I'll take that as a yes."
Mark laughs and pulls the bottle of liquor from Hardin's hand. Hardin still hasn't spoken either. He's just staring at me like I'm a ghost, like I'm an already forgotten memory that he never expected to have to revisit. I turn on my heel and push through anyone who gets in my path on my way out of hell. When I make it down one flight of stairs, I lean against the wall and slide down it, out of breath. My ears are ringing, and the weight of the last 5 minutes is crashing down on me. I don't know how I will make it out of this building. I listen in vain for the sound of boots slamming against the steel stairs, and each silent minute cuts deeper than the last. He didn't even come after me. He let me see him that way and didn't bother to chase after me with an explanation. I don't have any more tears to give him. Not today. But it turns out that crying without tears is much more painful than with, and impossible to control. After all this, all the fights, all the laughs, all the time spent together, this is how he chooses to end it? This is how he tosses me to the side? He has so little respect for me that he's getting high and letting that other woman touch him and wear his clothing after doing God knows what with her? I can't even allow myself to indulge that thought. It will cripple me. I know what I saw, but knowing and accepting are two different things. I am good at making excuses for his behavior. I have mastered that talent in the long months of our relationship, and I've been loyal to those excuses to a fault. But now there is no excuse. Even the pain he feels from the betrayal of his mother and Christian doesn't give him a pass to hurt me this way. I have done nothing to him to warrant what he's doing right now. My only mistake was trying to be there for him and putting up with his displaced anger for far too long. The humiliation and pain is transforming into anger the longer I sit in this empty staircase. It's a heavy, thick, overbearing fucking anger, and I am done making excuses for him. I'm done letting him do this shit and letting it go with just a simple apology and promise to change. No. Hell no. I'm not going out without a fight. I refuse to walk away and let him think it's okay to treat people this way. He obviously has no regard for himself or for me right now, and as the angry thoughts fill my head, I can't stop my feet from pounding back up those shitty stairs and back into that hellhole of an apartment. Pushing open the door so that it slams into someone, I make my way back to the kitchen. My anger surges further when I find Hardin still in the exact same spot, the exact same whore still attached to his back.
"No one, man. She's just some random,"
he's saying to Mark. I can barely see straight, I'm so angry. Before he can register me, I grab the bottle of vodka from Hardin's hand and throw it against the wall. It shatters and the room falls silent. I feel detached from my body. I'm watching an angry, outrageous version of myself losing her mind, and I can't stop her.
What the fuck, Bambi?
Mark shouts. I turn to him. My name is Tessa, I yell. Harden's eyes close, and I watch, waiting for him to speak up, to say anything.
Well, Tessa, you didn't have to break the vodka,
Mark sarcastically replies. He's too high to even care about the mess I made. Apparently his only issue is the liquor spilt. I learned how to smash bottles against walls from the best. I glare at Harden. You didn't tell me you had a girlfriend now, the skank latched onto Harden says. I look back and forth between Mark and the woman. There is an obvious resemblance, and I've read that letter too many damn times to not know who she is.
Leave it to Scott to bring a crazy-ass American chick into my flat, throwing bottles and shit,
Mark says, clearly amused.
Don't,
Harden says, stepping toward us. I give him my best poker face. My chest is rising and falling with deep, panicked breaths, but my face is a mask, a front devoid of any emotion, just like his.
Who is this chick?
Mark asks Harden, as if I were not standing there. Harden dismisses me again by saying,
I already told you.
Not even having the balls to look at me while degrading me in front of a room full of people. But I've had enough.
What the hell is wrong with you?
I scream. You think you can slum it here and smoke pot all day long to forget about your problems? I know how crazy